Hi, and welcome to the Kubernetes podcast from Google. I'm Craig Box.
And I'm Adam Glick.
Some sad news to share.
Yes, this will be my last week with the podcast. I'm excited to be moving on to my next adventure, but I will be leaving Google. So Craig will continue on the podcast without me, hopefully with a new host. One of the wonderful things about this community and the open source world is that things that are built live on beyond their creators. Other people get involved and they continue to do great things. It has been my true honor and pleasure to have done this for, gosh, what, 2¾ years at this point?
At least.
Bring this to all of you to be involved with the community. And this was our way to help give back to a community that we love so much. So thank you for allowing me to be part of your lives as you've listened to this. And Craig, this has been absolutely one of the highlights of my entire kind of working career, is getting to do this with you. So thanks to you as well for being a great co-host.
Well, thank you, Adam. And the same to you. Doing the show with you every week has been an absolute pleasure, a career highlight for me also. Just for people who don't know, Adam was really the driving force in getting the show off the ground within Google. I couldn't have asked for a better co-host. I'm very proud to say that he's become a wonderful friend. Sometimes people write in to thank what they assume is a giant team who put the show together every week. We have a little bit of help with booking and editing, but pretty much everything else related to the show has Adam's and my fingerprints all over it. And his departure obviously is going to be a great loss for the show. I know my mum will be heartbroken. I think she prefers your voice to mine.
I'm sure she loves you more. It's okay.
But again, congratulations on the new gig. I know it's a fantastic opportunity. I look forward to seeing continued great things for you in the future. For everyone else out there, please keep in touch with Adam. You can find him on LinkedIn. Please continue to listen to the show. We'll be bringing you a few episodes with some guest hosts, some names you may have heard in the past, and we'll have an update on how we take things forward. But ultimately, it should be very much like you're used to, just without the funny-sounding American guy.
Thank you very much, and thanks to all of you for listening. Shall we get to the news?
Let's get to the news. Dutch startup Red Cubes, with a K, has launched a community edition of its Otomi container platform and taken 1.2 million euros in seed funding. Having pivoted from a managed Kubernetes service to an add-on for any hosted version, Otomi provides one-click installation for add-ons on top of Kubernetes, such as Prometheus, OPA, Harbor, Istio, and Knative, from a web console. It then integrates monitoring and logging, CI/CD, and policy management. Red Cubes suggests you may prefer independence above and beyond what your provider offers, and hopes you will eventually move up to their enterprise edition.
With Google's Anthos general availability on bare metal, hyperconverged infrastructure, or HCI, vendors are starting to integrate it into their product portfolios. This week, Nutanix announced their HCI now runs Anthos without requiring a separate hypervisor license.
Last September, VMware announced the separation of their Tanzu product into different editions, and now an advanced edition is generally available. All the value-add technologies for developers and operators are now part of this edition, including build services, service mesh, and integration with the Spring framework. VMware also announced the rebranding of Pivotal Labs to Tanzu Labs. Along with the closure of Pivotal Web Services this week, VMware has purged almost all remaining remnants of the Pivotal brand. It took less than 18 months for the Tanzu brand to subsume Pivotal, which was almost 32 years old. The name still lives on in the Pivotal Tracker project management software. In hiring news, VMware is looking for a new CEO after Pat Gelsinger announced he would return to Intel on February 15th, the company where he previously worked for over 30 years. Send your applications to us, and we'll forward them on.
In GKE this week, the Container Storage Interface driver for Google Cloud Persistent Disks is now generally available. Previously, you would connect your disks using the in-tree GCE-specific code. This new code path allows you to take advantage of the new PD features without having to manually manage the CSI driver lifecycle. Google Cloud Operations for GKE, formerly Stackdriver, now also includes new modes where it offers only monitoring or only logging, as opposed to requiring both.
Founded by the creators of the Docker Slim open source project, a new startup called Slim.ai was announced this week. They launched with $6.6 million in seed funding to build a container DevOps platform. In this case, the AI stands for Application Intelligence, using static and runtime analysis to build and optimize containers. The platform integrates with CI/CD pipelines, container registries, and source repositories.
Grafana Labs' hosted product, Grafana Cloud, was updated this week with a new free tier and more generous limits for the paid plan. three team members can now access 10,000 time series and 50 gigabytes of logs for up to 14 days at no cost. The Pro plan now has five times the previous storage for $49 a month, and you can, of course, call for custom pricing if your requirements exceed those limits. Learn more about Grafana Labs in episode 122 with Torkel Udigard.
Sysdig has released their fourth annual Container Security and Usage Report, skipping 2020, don't we all wish we could do that, and labeling this report 2021. Insights included show that 74% of organizations are scanning container images in the build process. It's not all good news, though, as 58% of those containers run as root. Have we learned nothing? Interestingly, 21% of all containers run, according to survey respondents, live less than 10 seconds. Advertising included shows a 300% increase in the adoption of Sysdig's open source project Falco, which can mitigate the impact of bad configuration with runtime scanning. You can learn more about Falco in episode 91 with Leonardo Di Donato.
Listener Alvaro Hernandez wrote in with a "just because you can doesn't mean you should" blog post. He rented a bare metal machine from AWS and used it to run a 63-node Kubernetes cluster using Firecracker. Having tried 100 MicroKates nodes, 63 was the most he could get running. That sounds like a challenge someone else might want to accept. If you can get more nodes running on a single box, let us know.
Finally, a self-proclaimed definitive guide to vertical pod autoscaling from longtime listener Povilis Versokis. VPA provides an automatic way to set a container's resource requests and limits using historic CPU and memory usage data. It's available in open source Kubernetes or in an enhanced edition on GKE.
And that's the news. Chris Anizek is the Chief Technology Officer of the Cloud Native Computing Foundation and Vice President of Developer Relations at the Linux Foundation. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Glad to be here. Long time listener, so happy to finally have an opportunity to speak to all y'all.
We probably all had a similar path into technology. What was your path to Linux and open source?
You know, truly started when I was a younger child, just like anyone in our youth. We played video games. One of my first pieces of computing was a ZX Spectrum or ZX Spectrum, however you want to refer to it, where I learned how to play R-Type. There was this crazy jetpack game that was kind of cool that you kind of fly around with a jetpack. Got a 486 machine that my dad got me. Awesome. 66 megahertz, I believe, at the time. And part of that experience was there was this ridiculous gorilla game that he showed me, Gorilla at Best.
QBasic.
Yeah, QBasic was the intro to kind of programming. And, you know, with Gorilla at Best, you could open up Gorilla at Best and here's all the source code. I could go mess with kind of how the physics works and so on. So that was really kind of the first foray of, oh my gosh, I can make changes to this source file and change how this video game worked. And that kind of got me hooked into programming in general. And eventually, as I got older, high school times, we had a VAX cluster.
At your high school?
At the high school, yeah. Connecticut is very nice, privileged upbringing. And so I learned a little bit about DCL, I think was the programming language at the time. So kind of had a lot of fun things. And eventually that led to experimenting with Linux. At the time it was Slackware, eventually discovered Gentoo. I kind of had this thing where I was just like, this is amazing, compiling everything from scratch.
That's an interesting definition for amazing.
The cool thing about Linux in general, really why I'm involved in open source till this day, is when I was first getting involved, I couldn't get sound to work. I was trying to get the ALSA driver.
Did you try Windows?
I literally jumped onto IRC and just asked people like, hey, I'm having issues configuring this ALSA driver. And people from all over the world just pitched in and answered questions. There's nothing there. It was just like, here's answer. Hopefully you could solve your problem. And I kind of just got hooked to that just amazing community feel of people just answering my random esoteric Linux questions. And eventually that led to me becoming not only a user, but I was a maintainer. I maintained a lot of the JVM related packages on Gentoo for probably roughly 5 years before I got a full-time job and didn't have time to compile my kernel and packages from scratch every day.
So for someone who's obviously come from gaming and gone through high school, why Java? Why the JVM is your packages of choice?
That really became through some internships. One of my first professional internships was at a insurance company doing Java stuff. And so that's how I kind of learned it. Eventually, one of my co-ops university was with IBM. IBM, obviously, at the time, big Java shop. At the time, there was a couple things that they were doing. One was trying to fit the JVM on, let's call it like the home of the future, right? Like in small devices, like, hey, can we get JVMs running everywhere and sensors? I think they were calling it smart homes back in the day.
The refrigerator of tomorrow.
Like X10 kind of things over carrier current, that kind of stuff?
I think they were just too early. They had this lab of the future, they called it. And so I kind of got involved with JVM related things at that time. It eventually led to a long storied history with something called Eclipse. It was kind of the IDE that IBM acquired out of a company in Ottawa called OTI. They're essentially Visual Age folks, if you remember Visual Age back in the day. And they built Eclipse basically to simplify how IBM did internal development tooling and ensuring that they were not replicating building IDEs for each specific product and so on. And so I kind of got heavily involved with that community because I just love building developer tools. It's a lot of fun working on something that you get that immediate customer feedback.
You say immediate, but your IDE is written in Java. Don't you mean eventual customer feedback over time, maybe?
Well, you put it into an intermediary language and then eventually you get the feedback compiled for you.
In particular, Eclipse is pluggable just like Mozilla is in Chrome, right, with extensions. And so I was mostly responsible for what we call the plugin development environment. So other developers building extensions. And that feedback loop was super quick because developers would just get super pissed if you made small changes. I remember one time we went from essentially square corners to like beveled or curved corners for each file tab, and people just flipped the hell out and like sent nasty, at the time was Usenet messages, news groups to the developers.
You referred to Eclipse as the simplified developer experience.
I'd hate to see what a complicated developer experience looks like.
The Eclipse experience today feels a little bit like the open source version of Visual Studio, which is a very feature rich, but also compare that to some of the things like Atom or VS Code these days, or people that use VI. What was the experience like that was the simplified version?
If you recall, like back in the day, developer tools, you have your VI, Emacs folks.
QBasic.
Yeah, QBasic. If you're going to start debugging applications, right? Like I'm going to start a screen session or whatever. I'm going to go fire up GDB over there. And debugging was not a solidly integrated experience. The whole idea with Eclipse and integrated development environments in general was mostly all around, hey, can we have everything that you would require to debug, develop, maintain applications in one simple experience, supporting multiple languages too. So not only just Java, but C, C++, Python, Perl, all these things into one simple development experience. These days, I'm mostly a VS Code person. Eclipse is near and dear to my heart, but VS Code is a solid piece of engineering. And I do feel better that a lot of the original Eclipse people, folks like Eric Gamma, one of the Gang of Four folks that kind of helped steward a lot of the OG Eclipse stuff at IBM, went to Microsoft probably a decade ago, chartered with the mission to kind of build a web-based IDE. So I feel good about that.
Now, I don't want to let slide something you said before, Adam. You equated VS Code and VI as being roughly equivalent in terms of their complexity. You know, VS Code has an entire JavaScript environment just to write Hello World. Come on.
It's a spectrum.
But not a ZX spectrum.
That's been a pretty big shift that I've seen. So I was curious when you defined it as simple, what the experience was, because you mentioned developers give a lot of feedback.
Yep.
They're the kind of people who know that they could write a better IDE if only they had a spare weekend.
How do you deal with the fact that you're getting a lot of feedback, but there's also a lot of people who can contribute and certainly a lot of strong opinions about everything between tabs and spaces and coloring, and then also what are supported languages?
Roundness of corners.
Yeah, roundness of corners and so on. My lessons during those times was trying to be as transparent as possible with the roadmap and allowing people to get involved in what they truly cared about. I do think you still need a very small core set of folks to kind of make the decisions at the end of the day. I love that experience, but I don't know if I would ever be in a position again where I would want to go build a developer environment that so many people depend on. Like, I sympathize with the VS Code folks these days because it's becoming the de facto ID. If you look at the Stack Overflow survey results, and if you see like common IDs for all the languages, it's almost like VS Code is number one or number two for all of them. And that's just an incredible amount of communities that you have to support. I also think pushing things down to the plugin level or extension level. So if someone writes a Rust-based thing for VS Code, that community can own it, not necessarily people who own the extension infrastructure.
I'm seeing some parallels between that and how Kubernetes has chosen to expand out and other projects. How do you scale without creating giant monoliths?
Correct. Yeah, that's a fundamental lesson, trying to decentralize and distribute decisions as much as possible through an extension mechanism, whether it's plugins, Chrome extensions, or CRDs, for example. I think it's a key lesson for kind of scaling open source projects.
There's another aspect to this which I find quite relevant today, which is that you're working at a company who sort of as a side project happened to have a piece of technology, and then you went and worked with some people from that company who decided that they were going to leave and found a company to work on that full time. And then you followed through to Red Hat, and then also we'll touch maybe a bit on the Eclipse Foundation. How's that journey relate to what you see people do today?
Today, I think it's very common for people to develop a piece of software at a company, whether it's Twitter or a Facebook or some other large type organization. Then that piece of open source software gets popular. And then you're like, huh, you know, maybe I've worked here for 4 or 5 years. Maybe I want to do a startup around it, or VCs approach people to kind of do a startup about it. So I think it's a very common project that's produced at a larger company, becomes popular. Employees decide to potentially go do a startup. I think it's a cycle that we see all the time. We've seen it in the Kubernetes ecosystem plenty of times with folks like Craig and Joe who did Heptio. We're seeing it a lot in the CNCF ecosystem. I even came across a startup recently. We accepted Backstage, which is a developer portal recently, and there's a startup already around it called Rodi. I'm like, it's just a common, I think it's a good thing. Not everyone's going to work at a company forever. Millennials these days jump companies, what, like average tenure in Silicon Valley these days is like 1.5 to 2 years. I think you just kind of have to build in for that.
I feel like a dinosaur.
In my day, when we were at IBM early, before open source focused startups was popular, we were there about 5 years. A lot of us worked on Eclipse. We were approached by smaller companies that wanted support in either, hey, build us a custom plugin, or hey, can you build us a product around something? IBM at the time wouldn't care about these customers because maybe the revenue they would get from them is under $1 million.
Too small.
Yeah, too small. So they'd just ignore them. Eventually, we were like, you know what? Enough people are pinging us. And at the time, I was also finishing up business school at the University of Texas in Austin, where IBM graciously at the time had a program where they would pay for business school. I don't see that often these days, but that was an awesome thing that I'm super thankful for. I'm like, business school kind of brainwashed me or convinced me to, let's do a startup. This is great. It's going to be easy. So we did that. Eventually, a couple of us left, and we still maintained all these Eclipse projects. And then a week after we left, other IBMers at the time were like, what's going on? What are you doing? You're basically doing the same thing you're doing, answering questions and so on, but actually not getting paid for it now. Was a joke. I'm like, yeah, it took us like about 3 months to actually get our first revenue, but it was a fun experience. You learn a lot, especially if you put yourself in a challenging situation like doing a company from scratch. So I was super thankful for that experience.
So where did you head after the startup? It didn't quite become the unicorn.
No, we did okay. So it was interesting at the time is we had a lot of companies that were using Eclipse at scale. Folks like Cisco, even Google at the time was one of our customers, where I remember to this day visiting Mountain View and they're like, oh, Eclipse is a little bit slow.
Maybe it shouldn't be written in Java.
Yeah, it's like thousands of jars on the class path. And they're like, oh, we have another approach. What happens if we do a mega jar or fat jar? And we'll throw them all in wind and make it faster. So it was a lot of fun. So eventually what happened was Google ended up buying one of our competitors because they were building, I don't know if you remember this, I guess we're all a little bit old, Google Web Toolkit or GWT. Mm-hmm. Remember this at all?
Mm-hmm.
You'd write Java, cross-compile to JavaScript so you could use Eclipse to actually debug your JavaScript, because at that time, all we had was Firebug, right? We weren't blessed as we are today with like Chrome DevTools and be able to do breakpoints from your browser. So they eventually ended up buying that company there, and we decided to just go sell off the company. Not in the fire sale, but we sold it off, and I eventually went to Red Hat because I wanted to work on open source full time. And Red Hat was like, come please make JVM and Eclipse related stuff better on Red Hat Linux, and we'll pay you to do that.
You went IBM to Red Hat before Red Hat went to IBM?
Yes. I have the unfortunate or fortunate experience of being at both of those companies and experiencing the cultures. And I will say it's been interesting to watch how they have merged and allowed each other to have enough freedom to go about doing their business. So definitely different cultures, but I think they've been fairly successful giving Red Hat at least enough space to be successful. I truly believe Red Hat is a great, fantastic place to work as an engineer. They truly do care about upstream communities. But yeah, a fun experience. Don't recommend it.
So you spent a lot of time in open source and companies building open source tools, and then you shifted to the internet service world. What drove that shift?
When I was at Red Hat at the time, I loved my experience. We had a great team. I had a couple of colleagues that were reaching out to me. Google's doing some interesting things. A couple other Silicon Valley companies. Eventually, Twitter reached out. 2010, we started to have conversations, and they were like, so I'm familiar with the service, but why do you need my skill set in particular? Well, a couple things. One, we're in process of basically moving off of our Rails Ruby code base to the JVM. Obviously, I had a lot of JVM experience. And two, which was a little bit more interesting for me, was we're looking to basically figure out our open source strategy in general. Like, we've just randomly open sourced things, had some issues of not complying with licenses properly. We just need someone to kind of own this problem. Ideally, we'd love to have something similar to kind of like what Google does with Chris DiBona's office. And so I'm like, okay, that's kind of cool. Like, help some engineers with JVM stuff and also do some open source related things. This sounds like a fun opportunity. And we argued for about 6 to 12 months about the relocation to the Bay Area. I eventually sucked it up and moved over, enjoyed a couple of years in San Francisco. It was a crazy time. It was a typical startup growing significantly, had a lot of interesting infrastructure problems, which I learned a ton from. These days, we're blessed. CNCF has all these projects, Apache. At the time, there was really no open source orchestration options.
You had to roll your own for a lot of those things.
You had to roll your own, right? And we had, at the time, that was funny, the company was about 25% ex-Googlers too on the engineering side. So a lot of people are replicating stuff they had at Google. So it's like, we want Blaze. So we don't have Blaze. So we're going to build something called Pants.
I can see how you get from Blaze to Basil. How do you get from Blaze to Pants?
I don't know where the original name came, but it's ridiculous. The commands were like Pants Clean, Pants Wash, and you're like, all right, whatever, folks. But like Mesos came out of that. The company basically really truly wanted to open source a lot of the infrastructure it was building, because at the time it decided, look, we're in the business of advertising. Software is just a means to an end for that. So let's just open source all we can that's not related to our ads business, so we could attract great engineers and potentially get ahead of the market. Because a lot of stuff at the time, you couldn't just buy off the shelf. You kind of had to go create your own Redis or Memcache clustering mechanism and so on. So we shared all that. It was a great experience and was interesting to this day. I'm very torn because, you know, Mesos holds a special place in my heart, and I helped create MesosCon. I helped build a lot of that community. When the Kubernetes was getting popular, it's interesting to contrast how those communities competed and built out over time. Probably worthwhile for another long podcast, but it was a great experience.
About to say, how does the community view you given your current role of like, are you somewhere between Benedict Arnold and Judas or?
No, no. No, we're all friends. Ben Hindman, a lot of the Mesosphere, I guess D2IQ is the new name. I think that the lesson there is, if you're truly trying to build a ecosystem that involves multiple winners and so on, I think it's important sometimes to give up a little of that control. And I think the fundamental issue, I think, with Mesos is maybe it was a little bit too tightly controlled by one organization. They were not able to diversify properly, where I think Kubernetes did a fantastic job. A lot of the initial leadership, a lot of people were just very mindful about that and just built a better, more open, inviting ecosystem. Even though at the time, Mesos, I think, was just a better technology and so on. You could argue about two-level scheduling versus one-level scheduling and so on, but wider ecosystems win at the end of the day.
So on the topic of wider ecosystems, you are now, of course, at the Cloud Native Computing Foundation. How did you get from there to here?
So I was at Twitter for roughly 5 years and got lucky. You join a company early, goes through the typical Silicon Valley dream of going public and so on. So I was benefiting from that experience. But after 5 years of roughly going from a little under 100 engineers in the organization, and then 5 years later, it was about 2,000 engineers. I was a little bit burned out, to be honest. And I was like, you know what? I got a great opportunity here, a great exit, super fortunate. I'm going to go take some time off, maybe travel the world for 3 months or something. And during that experience, I got an email from Jim Zemlin, who runs the Linux Foundation. And he's like, hey, Chris, we're looking to start a foundation around Kubernetes. You have a lot of experience, obviously, with Mesos and all this container stuff. And we're also starting an organization around doing container standards. Open Container Initiative, which a lot of people don't know about, but played a very important part in the early days of CNCF. He's like, are you interested in helping build out and run these two organizations, kind of scaling them out? And I was like, nonprofit route sounds interesting. I don't think I'm ready to jump into a big company at the time or another startup. So why not? Let's try out this nonprofit opportunity. Sounds great. I've always wanted to be involved in a foundation. I've been involved in the Eclipse Foundation for nearly 15 years. So I'm like, this is great. This is an opportunity to kind of start something on my own. The downside is it turned out to be just as bad as a startup because it just grew crazy. The first year of CNCF was very relaxing. It was actually not that bad. It was very simple. We're just kind of get things bootstrapped. We're OCI. If you remember, we jokingly called like the container wars. It was a mess. The first year of OCI was just brutal.
Oh yeah.
And then CNCF picked up a year after that. I was just looking for a break. A lot of us work at these companies where sometimes you get burned out. You need a break. redoing engineering ladders like three times through Twitter is sometimes too much. Need something a little bit smaller.
Condensing it down to 140 characters at a time.
280 now, 280.
Oh, level 3 writes code. Level 4 writes code good.
Yeah, oh, no, exactly. Oh, yeah, I'm sure you go through the same experience. How do you rank each other? Do we do a scale of like 1 to 4, pass or fail? It's crazy, but every company goes through this. You kind of get burned out after a while, and everyone needs change at the end of the day. I think it's healthy to do new experiences and join new companies.
These days, you're the CTO of the CNCF.
Yep.
What is the job description for that?
I kind of started the organization as basically employee number one, started out as bootstrap executive director. The organization, we got it off the ground. It started to grow like crazy. We eventually ended up hiring the late Dan Kahn to run the business side as the executive director. But I prefer working with technical communities, cultivating them, growing them, and so on. And so as CTO of the organization, I'm essentially responsible for ensuring that our projects and maintainers are healthy and happy. My team essentially works on advocacy. We help projects put on events. We do technical writing for projects. We've built great sites for etcd, Kubernetes, IO. We help them move to Docsiens. We do a lot of services for projects, ensuring that they're fully happy, which is a little bit unique for organization. A lot of open source foundations generally are fairly lightweight in terms of staffing and support. Something with CNCF that I want to do is actually do provide project support, because a lot of times projects are comfortable just working on features and bugs. What do maintainers hate working on? Docs, right? Advocacy. Marketing, which a lot of developers don't see as important, but I actually view it crucial. To me, it's just as important as the code.
Yeah.
And a great way to involve people that are in non-code or non-technical roles into your project.
That is completely true. And I think you're highlighting one of the important things that the CNCF does for the community that not everyone thinks about, is all the things that you need besides just creating the code to have a successful project, that a successful community has all of these people working together and these different disciplines building something to make it great.
Yeah, 100%. And kudos to a lot of the original Kubernetes folks that were also very much on the same page. Sarah Novotny did a great job in the early days of pushing for this. And so it's kind of very easy to help convince other parts of the CNCF leadership and board that we should invest in this area. Because there's lots of fun conversations in the early days of, hey, whether we should pivot to be completely just the Kubernetes Foundation, or should we be more of a tent and more inclusive of other projects. So fun discussions during those days.
So what things do the CNCF not do by choice?
We generally do not hire people full-time to do feature work. For example, generally anything that would be blocking of a release or critical feature work, we don't do, because essentially that ends up competing with our member ecosystem. CNCF, we're a humble nonprofit, right? We do well, but we cannot compete with the trillion-dollar clouds out there for talent. It's just not at the same scale. Unless, like, if you're a hippie that want to work at a nonprofit, perfect. We got that market, but it is very difficult to compete with GSUs and all these folks. So that's generally what we do. And honestly, we don't think that's fairly healthy. And the way that works is, if you look at the Linux kernel itself, Linus and Greg KH work for the Linux Foundation. They're fellows. But if you know the Linux governance process, it's BDFL model, right? Benevolent dictator for life. Linus kind of controls things. And so having that person be employed by an independent foundation versus a company helps enable trust. Luckily, Kubernetes is distributed, open governance. There's multiple leaders, rotating steering committee, and so on. So you don't need that. And us hiring people to work full-time on Kubernetes for feature work doesn't make sense. But documentation, advocacy, that's completely okay. There's just less competition on the member ecosystem side for those types of hires. And people are generally very thankful if anyone contributes docs to a project.
One of the people that we've wanted to get on the show for quite a while and haven't had a chance to yet is Linus Torvalds. You're at the foundation. Have you had a chance to work with him? What's he like?
Linus is great. He's super humble and quiet in person, right? At KubeCon China, I think last year, we actually went on this crazy panda tour where we saw pandas and dressed up in these little crazy costumes to see the pandas. Linus is a super chill person. Online, he's probably a little bit more forward and direct. You know, given his Finnish roots, but always happy to answer questions and advice. I think both Linus and Greg H, who's number two in the hierarchy, Both are super receptive to questions. And in the early days when Kubernetes was starting, we actually brought in, I think, Greg KH and tried to get Linus at the time to kind of give advice on scaling governance. If you're interested in having Linus on the podcast, I could see what I could do.
Put in a pull request.
Yeah, I think Linus is perfect for Twitter, but I think there's been some issues in trying to get him. He's not a fan. He was a big Google Plus guy back in the day. Huge into the Google Plus.
Oh, wow.
We're sorry for breaking his heart.
I know. I think he was actually using it, but I don't think he's in Twitter because the brevity is too much. He's a little bit more long-winded.
You're also the VP of DevRel at the Greater Linux Foundation. Was that something that came up after the CNCF had run for a while, or was that something you'd been brought on to do at the beginning?
It was in the beginning. So one thing that many people don't realize is the Linux Foundation is essentially a network of foundations. There's things like CNCF, OCI, Let'sEncrypt.org, free SSL for everyone. They're fantastic. Love those folks. RISC-V Foundation. So I was brought in to kind of help figure out how we manage those communities. How do we keep developers across those communities happy? Which tools and services we should provide and so on. So if you look at a lot of the stuff that we've built, we have this new platform called LFX, which we've launched. And essentially just tools that we think are useful for projects. So for example, running internships. Like, we're huge fans of Google Summer of Code at CNCF and the Linux Foundation, but we've had a lot of requests for projects like, hey, I want to do an internship not in the summer. How about on demand? So we've built basically kind of like an internship as a service thing that projects do. And so it's been a fun thing because the LF now, we're over 200 employees, probably 40 to 50 of these sub-foundations. And we're constantly looking ways to improve to these developer communities and provide more services outside of just being a code host out there.
One of the neat things about your role is you get to see all the projects that are being proposed. You have a very good view of what's going on across the cloud native community and also a good sense for where things are going. What are your predictions for where you see cloud native and the CNCF going in 2021?
I'll break those apart into two things. There's cloud native and CNCF. Given that we talked a little bit about my Eclipse IDE experience and so on, I'm a huge proponent of just improving the developer experience overall for cloud native and Kubernetes developers. I think finally now that we've kind of agreed to a general orchestrator in the industry, people have embraced YAML, whether they love or hate it. We're moving to a point where IDEs are finally modernizing, where if you looked at, for example, the VS Code support for Kubernetes, it's gotten a lot better. It's pretty nice. But what other trend you're seeing now is, I don't know if you've played with GitHub Codespaces or Gitpod, for example, but essentially this whole idea is dev environment as a service. So basically you could specify in your YAML file what you actually need to properly build everything and get a development environment set up. So if a contributor comes to your project, they could literally just click open in Gitpod or open up in GitHub Codespaces.
Or Google Cloud Shell.
Or Google Cloud Shell. Yeah. Yeah. There's lots of options. I haven't played with that one yet, but behind the scenes, it would go fetch the Docker container image that you specified, set everything up and open up VS Code style experience where you can contribute, debug and build everything. To me, that's like where things are going to go, given that the technology there, I think, is finally ready to enable that. So I think you're going to see a lot of innovation in what I call like the cloud native IDE space. That's great. I mean, if you go to, for example, Prometheus, one of our projects uses Gitpod. If you go to the Prometheus website or GitHub repo, there's a little badge that says open up in Gitpod and boom, everything a developer needs to do to actually contribute to that project is booted up in like 30 seconds. That's awesome. Like back in the day, that's been a nightmare. I tried to build a business around standardizing people's Eclipse development environments back in the day because what happens your first day at work?
You compile your Gen 2 installation and you install the JVM.
Yeah, you get all that configured, all your editor settings, you argue about tabs or spaces, depending which language you're using. And having that just configured and in a shareable construct so you could share with other developers is huge.
It's devsetup.bat as a service.
Yes, yeah, we want to go that way. So I think you're going to see a lot of excitement in this space moving forward. A couple other areas we're seeing a lot of interest, at least since I could see the sandbox project backlog that we have in terms of applications in CNCF, is there's a lot of WebAssembly or WASM-related projects that are starting to pop up. Within the CNCF ecosystem itself, there's a couple trends. One, for folks that were using either like a JavaScript or like a Lua-style VM for scripting or whatever, are seeming to move to WASM for this purpose. So if Envoy is a good example where they have this built-in Lua mechanism where you can write filters in Lua. That seems to be transitioning to be done in WASM in the future. There's other projects there that are trying to figure out, how do I run WASM in a Kubernetes context, right? So there's folks, I think Microsoft put together something like Crosslit. There's a couple other WASM container runtimes out there that are trying to accomplish this task. So I think you'll see more WASM and cloud native in the coming year, even though WASM is still very early days and they kind of have to improve the spec to support everything you would need in running WASM outside the browser. I think there's the WASI spec, which is kind of improving.
Do you think that this is a case of you'll support running WASM workloads instead of containers? Or do you think this is a use case where you will have an orchestrator that does to WASM workloads what Kubernetes did to containers?
I think the latter there. If you look now, we have projects like Kubevert that treat VMs orchestrated like we would orchestrate containers in Kubernetes, right? I think WASM will just be another workload side by side potentially to these that the Kubernetes ecosystem supports. On top of that earlier case where I mentioned where folks like Envoy, maybe dependent on something like Lua, they're just going to rip that apart and use WASM to handle their little extension mechanism.
Being able to run lighter weight workloads opens up a lot of edge use cases for lower powered devices as well. There's a lot of new projects in this space. Is this something you see as being a direction of the foundation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, outside of late last year, we had the K3S project join the CNCF sandbox. I have the unique position to talk to a lot of our member companies from all different industries. And it just seems like the last, I would say, 6 to 12 months, the telco industry has just kind of woken up and all of a sudden is very much set on making Kubernetes the dominant platform to run edge-based workloads in their 5G and future settings. So I think you're just going to see a lot of interest in stretching Kubernetes to support those use cases. And the way we kind of talk about it internally is it's kind of just like Linux. Linux started out, Linus posted something on Usenet, very hobbyist type thing. And eventually end users took Linux, stretched it to work on embedded platforms, real-time settings, mobile, obviously. Android took over the world in many
ways. Non-386 CPUs.
I think you're going to see the community stretch Kubernetes in that setting. And it's going to be interesting to see how that is done because I feel the maintainers have a stressful duty to ensure that Kubernetes works and doesn't break for anyone. So how these kind of things happen over time is going to be interesting to watch. But my feeling is this year is going to be a lot of people stretching Kubernetes to make it useful on the edge. And we will be doing our first KubeCon Europe. We're going to be doing a Kubernetes Edge Colo event in May. Excited to help foster that adoption.
Finally, you're fairly active on Twitter. You clearly were there fairly early on as you have a three-letter alias.
And a Twitter mug.
Oh, yeah, I do have a Twitter mug right now, yeah.
Three-letter acronyms are often used by government agencies, NHS, IRS. Have you run into any naming conflicts?
Absolutely. This is something I didn't learn because, like I mentioned earlier, ZX Spectrum was my first thing. And so the handle I've been using forever has been ZX, right? I couldn't get that at Twitter at the time. There was like an inactive account policy where if they didn't log in for a year, an employee could request the handle. And it was like 11 months in and this guy in Japan owned ZX and he logged in and I was like, no, I can't get it. And so, so angry. And he didn't tweet at all, which drove me crazy. He just logged in to read. Most people just log into Twitter and read. So I'm like, oh no, doesn't even tweet anything. So I'm like, all right, I'm just going to use my initials. And so I was like, oh, let's get CRAs available. Eventually, what I learned throughout the year is that is also the initials for the Canadian version of the IRS, the Canadian Revenue Agency. So throughout the year, I get these angry tweets from Canadians complaining about the CRA. And sometimes I have to correct them, like go complain to the CanRev agency. But I'm like, look, Canadians, compared to Americans, you get great healthcare, great social benefits, stop complaining and pay your taxes. So it's my kind of annual reminder for folks. But yeah, downsides of short Twitter handles.
I guess it reminds you every year when the time that the tax filing comes up in Canada.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have to mute people all the time. It's just like, you know what? Stop complaining. You have great benefits, great healthcare.
All right, Chris, thank you very much for joining us today.
No worries. Great to be on.
You can find Chris Anizek on Twitter at CRA or on the web at anizek.org. And you can find out how to spell that in the show notes. Thank you for listening. As always, if you've enjoyed the show, please help spread the word and tell a friend. If you have any feedback for us, you can find us on Twitter at KubernetesPod or reach me at least by email at KubernetesPodcast@google.com.
You can also check out our website at KubernetesPodcast.com where you'll find transcripts and show notes, as well as links to subscribe.
I'll be back next week.
And I hope to see you all around the community. Take care.